Good morning, everybody. It is 3 minutes after 11 o'clock. Let's call the first meeting of the Joint Armed Services Committee of the 28th Legislature to order. Let the record reflect that we have present with us Senator Dyson, Senator Faircloth, Senator Coghill, Senator Wilikowski, Representative Feige, Representative Isaacson, Representative Lynn, Co-Chair Senator Kelly, myself, Co-Chair Sadler. We also have with us Representative Ledoux and Representative Thompson. And do I see anybody else? And Representative Tarr. And if there's room at the table, you can certainly come up and be seated. Great. If there's room, please come up, Representative Ledoux, Representative Thompson, if you can. Yeah, Tarr's already here. Public members present this morning. We have Brigadier General George Canellis, Alaska Air National Guard, retired. Colonel Tim Jones, U.S. Army, retired. And Lieutenant General Tom Case, I believe, is here. I didn't see Tom. General Case? Okay. Not yet. I'd like to advise everybody to please stash your cell phones, kill them. The vibrations and noise does interfere with the recording of the system and the PA, so please kill your cell phones. Before we begin this morning's meetings, I'd like to give a brief bit of background on the JAS Committee. We were established in the 1990s. In response to the first Base Realignment and Closure Commission, JAS is comprised of 5 representatives and 5 senators and 6 public members that represent the interests of the military services and agencies, local governments, Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, and Alaska Natives. Our stated mission is to monitor and address potential realignments of military facilities and missions in the state, to advocate for the National Missile Defense System, to seek out ways to attract new missions to Alaska bases, and to support increased joint training activity in Alaska. And I would say that our mission is especially important these days as our country faces tremendous budget pressures, both the planned reductions and those that may be forced upon us by the budget sequestration process or whatever else they cook up back in the Potomac. It's important for us all here and around the state to keep in mind that Alaska's military services and agencies are essential for national security, for joint training and preparedness, for force projection, for the stability of our economy, and for the safety of our people. This morning we're pleased to have presentations from some of the top military leaders in the state. We have Air Force General, Lieutenant General Stephen Hogue, who is Commander of Alaskan Air Command and the U.S. Pacific Command and several other commands. Alaska National Guard Major General Thomas Kakis, who is the TAG and the Commissioner of the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. And Coast Guard Rear Admiral Thomas Ostebo, who is Commander of the 17th District. We're under a little bit of a tight timeline this morning, so I'd like to welcome our guests. Lieutenant General Hogue is first. So I invite you to the podium, sir, with yourself and your aides to give us your presentation, your comments. It's my intention to allow the presentations to proceed to their conclusion and hold questions until after each presenter delivers their presentation. And with that, General Hogue, we need to state your name and title on the record for the Secretary and then proceed. Okay. Welcome here.
Lieutenant General Steve Hogue, Commander 11th Air Force. Been up here for about 14 months now, and I met many of you last time around. So, good morning, Chairman Sadler, Chairman Kelly, and members of the Joint Armed Services Committee. I appreciate the opportunity to update the body on the successes of the U.S. military unit stationed here in Alaska in 2012 and the opportunities and the challenges we'll face in 2013. Next slide. First, we'd like to honor our fallen. I think it's fitting to acknowledge and appreciate the ultimate sacrifice the servicemen stationed in Alaska who gave their lives in the service of their country over the past year. Today, I'd like to highlight some of the many accomplishments of the U.S. military units here in Alaska from 2012 and address 3 restructuring changes followed by a review of the deployments of our servicemen and women. Our 2012 calendar was full of various exercises, and 2013 will be no different in that respect. I will address each of these and highlight the value of the Joint Pacific-Alaska Range Complex, along with some other recent and upcoming events. Then I will discuss the multifaceted and complex challenges of Arctic engagement in light of the unprecedented Arctic access from this last summer. Finally, I'll talk about Joint Task Force Alaska Operations, Alaska NORAD region, missile defense entities in Alaska. We currently have 5 ongoing environmental impact statements I will address, and before I conclude with some of the challenges we'll face in the coming year and beyond. As you know, we have a large military presence across the state. And aside from major installations denoted by the stars you see here, Alaska Grid is peppered with long-range radar stations and radio relay sites. Counting the active-duty soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, and Coast Guardsmen, there are over 23,000 service members here in Alaska. When you add the members' dependents and the 5,000 Department of Defense civilians, the active-duty military makes up over 10% of the state's population. And as many of you know, when the veterans and retirees are added, that figure becomes about a quarter of the state's population. Each of the three Air Force wings in Alaska can boast a long list of accomplishments in 2012, but here are a few that I'd like to highlight today. The third wing continues to shine as the Air Force premier total force integration wing. Air Force Reserve Command's 477th Fighter Group integrates pilots and maintainers seamlessly with the two active duty F-22 squadrons, while the Alaska National Guard's 249th Airlift Squadron flies side by side with their active duty crew members every day. Over the past several months, maintainers have upgraded several of the F-22s stationed at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson with a hardware and software modification called Increment 3.1. This upgrade allows Raptors to map ground targets in real time with synthetic aperture radar and employ small diameter bombs along with other combat capabilities. These Alaska-based Raptors are the first Air Force F-22s to undergo this 3.1 upgrade. Recently, Pacific Air Force has presented the third wing with its Safety Special Achievement Award in recognition of extraordinary safety despite austere conditions. In 2012, with a winter record snowfall, the third wing flew 7,000 sorties, totaling more than 15,000 flight hours, delivered more than 2,000 passengers and over 4 million pounds of cargo in support of Pacific and Central Command missions, all of these without a mishap. Over the same period, the 3rd Maintenance Group was awarded the Dedalion Weapons System Maintenance Trophy for 2012, cited for exceptional effectiveness rates, consistent repairs, and modifications ahead of schedule, and all the time with worldwide support for both training and contingency operations. The 673rd Air Base Wing, J-Bear's host, also had a banner year, and when you read the list of their accomplishments, it's easy to see how they earned their first Air Force Outstanding Unit Award. A year ago, the 673rd Medical Group hosted a grand opening for its Fisher House, and it just recently completed its new traumatic brain injury clinic. In July, many of you enjoyed the Arctic Thunder 2012 air show, the largest air show that J-Bear had had to date. Hosted over 230,000 visitors to see 73 participating aircraft, including the F-22 demonstration, the Air Force's Thunderbirds, and the Army Golden Knight parachute team. This very successful air show helped educate the public on several of the military's weapon systems while developing and expanding community partnerships in Anchorage and the surrounding communities, unless you happen to be in the highway heading south that day, but that's another story. As summer faded into fall, J-Bear began operations with its new landfill gas power plant in September. In a three-way partnership with the municipality of Anchorage, Dorion Utilities, J-Bear now receives electricity generated from processed methane collected from the Anchorage landfill. This methane, which was previously vented off and burned to the atmosphere, will provide 25% of the total energy demand on J-Bear, helping the base far exceed the requirements of the 7% renewable energy set forth in two executive orders in the Environmental Protection Act of 2005. A grant from the Alaska Energy Authority, coupled with a tax benefit from the federal government, will help this project turn cash positive within 5 years. As a whole, this project represents a phenomenal success of collaboration between the municipality of Anchorage, J-Bear, and private industry. On the other side of the Alaskan range, the 354th Fighter Wing at Eielson Air Force Base kept busy. Last winter, the 18th Aggressor Squadron took a mobile training team to Guam to support the first ever trilateral Cope North exercise with the Royal Australian Air Force and the Japanese Air Defense Force. In fact, they are again deployed to Guam for Cope North today, 2013, as we speak. This was followed by a seasonal support to the Hawaiian Air National Guard, helping F-22 unit there achieve initial operation capability. The 354th Wing summer was filled with three Red Flag Alaska exercises, which I will highlight in a few slides, after which the 18th Aggressor Squadron Mobile Training Team left for PACOM's Exercise Valiant Shield in Australia. Also of note, Eielson's Ted Stevens Joint Mobility Complex effectively supported several U.S. Army Alaska deployments and redeployments with nearly 4,000 soldiers and 600 short tons of cargo processed. On the 28th of September in 2012, Pacific Air Command deactivated 13th Air Force Headquarters out of Joint Base Pearl Harbor, Hickam. At that time, the two wings under 13th Air Force, the 15th Joint Wing at Joint Base Pearl Harbor, Hickam, and the 36th Wing at Joint Base Joint Region Marianas, Anderson Air Force Base, were realigned under 11th Air Force. This restructuring did not involve any personnel moves into Alaska, but it expanded 11th Air Force Command across the majority of the Pacific and increased our number of personnel to over 13,000. While our national strategy is shifting to focus on the Pacific region, 11th Air Force now is responsible for the Air Force wings that form the strategic triangle you see above in that vast area. The other upcoming restructuring to address is the deactivation of the 537th Airlift Squadron at J-Bear. The 537th is the active duty associate squadron with the Alaska Air National Guard's 144th Airlift Squadron, composed of 42 crew members and 13 other personnel. This deactivation will accompany the retirement of four of the Alaska National Guard C-130s. Lastly, as I indicated last year, the Pacific Air Force's Band of the Pacific at Joint Base Pearl or at J-Bear will deactivate this summer, with the remaining 15 personnel being sent overseas. For U.S. Army Alaska, the primary highlight last year was the deployment and redeployment of nearly 8,000 soldiers in support of Operation Enduring Freedom. Now that they're back home, the 1st of the 25th and the 4th of the 25th are again sharpening their edge. The 425th is focusing on the joint forceful entry operations, and the 1st of the 25th Striker Brigade is training for other major combat mission sets. The 2nd Engineer Brigade participated in major exercises in India and Korea last year and continues to have troops deployed worldwide today. The 16th Combat Aviation Brigade is also staying active in support of global aviation requirements, on top of supporting the recent Kulik salvage operation, which I will address later. In honor of the 2011 and 12 deployments, Fort Wainwright dedicated Monterey Lakes Memorial Park and the Sergeant Joel Clarkson Training Support Center. In May, it gathered over 6,000 service members, veterans, family members, and supporters for the Salute to Our Military Parade, or STOMP, and drew a crowd of 10,000 viewers. Much like J-Bear, Fort Wainwright has been lauded for its installation excellence, evident from the Installation Management Command Exemplary Workforce Development Award it received last year. Fort Wainwright is also part of the TARP U.S. Army Residential Communities Initiative Project.
General Hogue, excuse me, this might be an appropriate time for the record to acknowledge that Representative Tammy Wilson of that region is here with us. Thank you, sir.
U.S. Army Alaska has been asked to concentrate its efforts on the Asia-Pacific region. This renewed focus will increase the number of training opportunities and exchanges with foreign militaries to improve partnerships, readiness, and cooperation between Pacific-based armies and the United States. This will allow our Alaska-based units to train, share tactics, techniques, and procedures while developing enriched appreciation for the culture and professional traditions of partner nations within the Pacific. For our Army in Alaska, taking a greater role in the Pacific also presents opportunities to demonstrate expertise in the Arctic. The U.S. Army Northern Warfare Training Center here in Alaska provides some of the best cold and mountain warfare training in the world. U.S. Army Alaska is uniquely positioned to support emerging security requirements in the Pacific and the Arctic by being an Arctic-trained, Pacific-focused, credible ground force capable of rapidly deploying to multiple regions around the world. As I've already mentioned, the nation called on many of the servicemen and women stationed in Alaska to deploy in support of national interests in 2012. From the two Air Force wings at J-Bear, almost 900 personnel deployed across the globe to 66 different locations, with a large proportion of them going to support combat operations in the Middle East. Last summer, the 90th Fighter Squadron provided a forward posture in the Pacific at Anderson Air Force Base, while the 962nd Airborne Air Control Squadron continues to provide a rotation of crews to CENTCOM. The 425 Airborne Brigade from J-Bear and the 125 Striker Brigade from Fort Wainwright returned home from their tours of service in Afghanistan with a combined total of over 8,000 soldiers. As you can see, we still have many Alaska-based servicemen and women serving abroad, with over 1,000 personnel currently deployed. As the military's footprint in the Middle East draws down, personnel based in Alaska continue to support missions across the globe, from Djibouti to Laos to the Honduras. Alaska has been home to a robust exercise program for those forces that are not deployed. In 2012, we hosted three Red Flag Alaska exercises with 9 visiting countries. These large force exercises provide realistic and combat representative training environments for all participants. Prior to last summer, the Polish Air Force had never flown an exercise out of its own borders. And by coming to Alaska, they're able to take advantage of an airspace structure that is simply unfathomable if you're stationed in Europe. Last year, we broke U.S. Northern Command's Exercise Arctic Edge into 4 separate compartmentalized exercises to better hone the Joint Task Force Alaska Homeland Defense and Civil Support mission sets. First, Ardent Sentry was designed to validate and verify the defense support to civil authorities' roles and missions. For 8 days, we established a 24/7 Joint Operations Center and partnered with U.S. Coast Guard District 17 for two tasks: a simulated event off the coast of the North Slope and a search and rescue operations in an isolated area in central Alaska. Along with strengthening that vital partnership within the state, we're also able to procure, field, and test a significant improvement to the Alaska National Guard search and rescue capability through addition of a 72-hour, 25-person airdroppable Arctic sustainment package that remains in their possession for use today when necessary. In Alaska Shield, my headquarters and JBIR installation partnered with the State of Alaska for Homeland Defense and Security and Emergency Management with a series of planning sessions centered on extreme cold weather event in Alaska. While the focus was on individual preparedness, we also addressed how such an event would impact the installation and what role we might play in supporting statewide recovery efforts. In Arctic Care, Total Force medical personnel assisted in the planning and execution of this important event, which brings real-world medical care to Alaskans in remote locations. Arctic Shield provided another opportunity to team with District 17 in our first joint operational exercise of U.S. Coast Guard and Department of Defense oil skimming equipment off the coast of Barrow in August. We successfully deployed and operated both Coast Guard and DOD skimming equipment from the Coast Guard cutter. This was the first time DOD equipment had been used in this fashion in Alaska. We captured many lessons learned with regard to execution and logistics. And finally, an excellent exercise, Vigilant Shield 2013, which was held last October, was a NORAD-NORTHCOM exercise designed around the Homeland Defense mission in Alaska. This exercise involved Alaska NORAD region and Joint Task Force Alaska is the annual reminder that Alaska's strategic location significantly enhances the security and safety of the U.S. and our partners in North America. Looking ahead to 2013 exercise season, Alaska will host two red flag exercises with eight other participant countries. Between the two red flags, Northern Edge Exercise 2013, this is U.S. Pacific Command sponsored exercise, which we conduct every other year, will draw up to 10,000 personnel to conduct defensive counter air, counter surface maritime interdiction, personnel recovery, and limited air and space operations training. Historically, Northern Edge exercises have included a Navy strike group, special operations forces, and all of our military services. Further on the horizon, we are already deep into planning for a 2014 Arctic Edge exercise. Over the past 6 months, we have been working hand-in-hand with the State Department of Alaska Homeland Security and Emergency Management and the Alaska National Guard to align our planning efforts for a combined Alaska Sealed Arctic Edge, Arctic Sentry, and Vigilant Guard exercise. The central theme of this exercise will be a major earthquake response similar to the Great Alaska Earthquake of 1964. Linking these major events will allow us to ensure we can react with an all-of-government effort to this catastrophic disaster scenario, putting our DOD support behind the efforts of the State of Alaska to deal with this crisis. As this committee is well aware, the Joint Pacific Air Range Complex, or JPARC, provides a training space that makes many of the exercises I mentioned possible. Such a large and unencumbered training space is extremely valuable for the U.S. military's training exercises, as well as our partner nations. Simply inviting another nation to participate in Red Flag Alaska, for example, is an important means of building and strengthening alliances. We learn how to operate better together militarily and exercise co-developed plans. This past November, we hosted over 30 tribal chiefs and presidents for our quadrennial tribal and military leaders meeting. This forum allows dozens of military commanders from military installations around the state to engage with tribal leaders to hear their concerns, discuss military activities for the upcoming year. Our goal was to reach beyond the conventional Department of Defense channels to enhance understanding and cooperation between the military and federally recognized tribes. Of note, American Indian and Alaska Native serves in the military in the largest percentage of any ethnic group, and several of the tribal leaders in attendance this year were veterans. The photo you see here came from our tour of the 212th Rescue Squadron hangar, where we showed the tribal leaders the search and rescue resources available on JBIR. Recently, my command participated in the Alaskan Forum on the Environment. This forum is designed to bring many organizations and entities together to discuss concerns about the environment, to share information and ideas, prevent future damages, and resolve existing issues. since 1991, signatories to the Statement of Cooperation have pledged to communicate, partner, and collaborate, train and educate, and uphold these core goals. These agencies have shared many successes, including cutting costs for mobilization and demobilization at remote sites, achieving best practices and processes for site cleanup, and a high degree of technology dissemination among the partners to improve collective capabilities. 2 days ago, Rear Admiral Oosterbo and I flew to Dead Horse for an orientation tour of the North Slope so I could learn about the oil spill response operations. The President of Alaskan Clean Seas, North Slope Oil Response, graciously hosted us and familiarized me specifically with the operation. I think we all know that no one agency can build all the infrastructure we need, and we are looking for ways to partner creatively and share when it makes sense for our specific DOD missions. As evidence of the strong support of our military, the Armed Services YMCA is hosting its 36th annual Salute to the Military event tomorrow evening, and they have invited General Charles Jacoby, Jr., the commander of U.S. Northern Command in NORAD, as a guest speaker. The Armed Services YMCA is just one of the many organizations that provide extraordinary support in everything they do. The Association of the United States Army and the Alaska ACES Hockey Organization are two morgues groups that have raised thousands of dollars to support programs for our service members and their families, and we are extremely grateful. As human activity and global interests increase in the Arctic Council remains an effective forum for non-security issues. U.S. Northern Command has tasked Joint Task Force Alaska to consider potential future military capabilities and gaps for the Arctic, with prioritization on safety, security, defense, and cooperation. The last priority of cooperation is key, given the resource constraints within the Department of Defense, and any progress towards securing and developing the Arctic will require significant coordination, collaboration, and cooperation. Currently, we've identified four primary gaps we need to address. These are communications, maritime domain awareness, infrastructure, and presence. In that spirit of collaboration and cooperation, JTF Alaska has begun discussions with the University of Alaska Fairbanks to potentially partner with an ALCOM JTF Alaska Arctic Elastic Bureau. By formalizing an enduring relationship with the university, JTF Alaska can tap into the vast academic knowledge and expertise on the Arctic while identifying the capability gaps we mentioned before. Joint Task Force Alaska kept busy last year engaging with partners across the state to accomplish unique operations. For example, when the Alaska Army National Guard discovered newly exposed records from the 1952 crash of a C-124 Globemaster on Colony Glacier, Alaskan Air National Guard pararescue experts were able to confirm the presence of human remains. JTF Alaska assembled a joint total force team of service members and civilians to conduct recovery operations on that hazardous and unforgiving terrain of an active glacier. As you can see from this photo, the glacial surface was an austere environment. The joint POW-MIA accounting command conducted recovery operations on the glacier to recover human remains in order to help bring closure to the families that lost loved ones some six decades ago. The Army's Northern Warfare Training Center played a critical role in training and monitoring teams on the glacier to ensure their safety, while the U.S. Army Guard U-860 crews provided transportation logistics support. The 673rd Air Base Wing medics and honor guards received and processed the human remains with the dignity and respect they deserved. At the end of the operation, JTF Alaska worked with the University of Alaska at Fairbanks to install a glacier tracking system to monitor the melt and overall condition of the glacier, so next year we can return to reevaluate the site for newly uncovered items. More recently, a pair of CH-47Fs Chinooks from Fort Wainwright were tasked to support operations in response to the grounding of the Shell Oil Arctic drilling rig Kulik in late December. Chinooks from the 16th Combat Aviation Brigade were able to rapidly deploy and successfully deliver essential power and hydraulic equipment despite difficult weather and dynamics of the sling low operations in support of Coast Guard District 17's efforts. The Alaska NORAD region, or ANR, continues to maintain readiness in its two mission sets, the asymmetric Operation Noble Eagle and the traditional symmetric Air Defense Identification Zone, or ADIS, protection. ANR works closely with the Canadian NORAD region to ensure complete Arctic coverage. In the near future, with the Automatic Backup Oxygen System Upgrade, or ABOS, the F-22s based at JBIR will resume their traditional alert role and return to fully mission combat status for NORAD operations. In Alaska's interior, two missile defense bases are providing better protection than ever before. Just outside Delta Junction, Fort Greely's Missile Defense Complex recently completed the construction of Missile Field 2 with 14 operational silos. Greely also integrated its new power plant with the ground-based interceptor field missiles and installed a second ground mid-course defense communications network node to enhance warfighting testing and training capabilities. On the business end of the missile defense, Greely upgraded the exo-atmospheric kill vehicles to improve intercept performance and increase its lethality. Similarly, Clear Air Force Station near Anderson, Alaska, also upgraded its capabilities and security. The new emergency power plant can provide full power to the paved pause radar in the event that power is lost from the existing coal plant. The system's design will automatically switch power seamlessly to prevent a gap in surveillance coverage. The paved pause 10.2 and upgraded early warning radar enhancements are hardware and software modifications that will increase the tracking capability and fidelity of the PACE PAW and tie it to the Fort Greely's ballistic missile defense system for increased ground-based interceptor accuracy, similar to the systems at Thule Air Station and Beale Air Force Base. On the security side, the high-altitude electromagnetic pulse project is a three-year construction project to harden the paved PAW's radar infrastructure against an electronic magnetic pulse attack. This should be accomplished next year. In an effort to cut energy costs, Clear Air Force Station will tie into the commercial power grid and close its aging coal power plant in the years ahead through the Energy Conservation and Investment Program. We have five ongoing environmental impact statement initiatives and one programmatic environmental assessment I'd like to bring to your attention, the first of which is regarding J-Park. While the training spaces in the lower 48 are being encroached upon by other interests, the JPAR is expanding its space and capabilities. Alaskan Command, on behalf of U.S. Army and U.S. Air Force, in accordance with the National Environmental Protection Act, Policy Act, has prepared the final JPARC Modernization and Enhancement EIS, which includes the results of the environmental analysis of the proposed JPARC alternatives. The EIS analysis, potential environmental consequences associated with expanding and establishing new military operation areas, restricted airspaces and corridors, and ground maneuver training spaces and training complexes. About a month from now, the JPARC final EIS notice of availability will be published and the final EIS will be available on the JPARC website. The final EIS will incorporate all the comments received during last summer's public comment period and the applicable responses. After a 30-day waiting period for public review, a final record of decision will be published in June. We believe the JPARC Modernization and Enhancement EIS will reach a mutually beneficial conclusion for both military units in Alaska and the other land and airspace users across the state. Next, in accordance with the National Environmental Policy Act, the Air Force Center for Engineering and Environment will prepare a draft EIS for the proposed relocation of the 18th Aggressor Squadron from Eielson Air Force Base to J-Bear and the right sizing of the remaining overhead and base operating support at Eielson. The public scoping meetings were held last week to determine the subject of analysis during the draft EIS, which will analyze potential environmental consequences associated with the proposed relocation. The proposal includes two alternatives, plus a no option or no action option. As you can see on the timeline, there will be a 60-day public comment period this summer to refine the analysis prior to moving to the preliminary EIS. In addition, the Department of the Navy is preparing a supplemental to the 2011 Gulf of Alaska Navy Training Activities EIS and Overseas EIS. The supplemental EIS will support authorization of incidental takes of marine mammals under the Marine Mammal Protection Act and incidental takes of threatened and endangered marine species under the Endangered Species Act. The current federal regulatory permits and the authorizations expire in May 2016. As part of the supplemental EIS, the Navy will use new acoustical model to estimate protected potential marine species effects. Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson is preparing a supplemental draft EIS for the resumption of year-round firing opportunities. This supplemental will include the government's response to public comment received in the initial draft EIS issued in 2010, and JBAR anticipates releasing the supplemental draft EIS for a 60-day public comment period in mid-2013. The supplemental analysis will focus on potential environmental consequences associated with providing JBIR units the opportunity to conduct indirect live fire training through the year, rather than the current arrangement of using the existing Eagle River Flats impact area in the winter and sending the units to the interior for training in the summer. The proposed action has not changed from the initial draft EIS, although mitigation measures have been revised to be more protective of the environment, specifically the endangered Cook Inlet, beluga whale, and the migratory birds. Once again, there will be a public comment period this summer. Fort Wainwright is home to two World War II historic hangars at the Ladd Field Historic Landmark. Several options have been considered for the disposition of these hangars, and unfortunately, renovation and rehabilitation is not physically possible. As such, Fort Wainwright is studying whether they should demolish the two hangars or allow them to deteriorate until they collapse on their own. The Fort Wainwright commander will make a final decision a year from now. Finally, the Department of the Army completed a final programmatic environmental assessment and draft finding of no significant impact for Army future force structure reductions and realignments that may occur in the fiscal years 2013 to 2020. The programmatic environmental assessment, known as a PEA, analyzed the environmental impacts of potential reductions in Army forces necessary to reduce spending while maintaining critical national defense capabilities. JBIR and Fort Wainwright are among 21 bases being analyzed and considered for force structure realignments. Final decisions as to which alternatives to implement and which installations will see reductions, unit realignments, or possible additions have not yet been made. The implementation of the Army force structure realignment will occur over the course of several years to arrive at an optimally configured force in 2020. In an effort to control energy costs while augmenting energy security, I've initiated an executive energy steering group to pool together the body of knowledge on this subject from the Department of Defense, State of Alaska, and federal and industry representatives. Our goal is to lower energy costs for Alaska's military installations over the next 2 to 7 years. So far, we've held two of these quarterly meetings, and we're starting to piece together the full scale of the challenges. While the energy piece is a significant concern for our cold weather bases, it represents just one subset of larger issues of resource management. Included in this is how we take care of our great servicemen and women. Suicides within the military have risen dramatically, and over the past few years across all of our demographics. The services are actively engaging on this issue to increase awareness, provide support for our members, and drive the number of suicides down as far as possible. Likewise, sexual assaults have also risen to the surface as a significant issue across the services. Each branch is attacking this problem and doing the best to root out the people that simply don't belong in our service. I think everybody here is waiting with as much anticipation as I am to see what happens with the sequestration and the budget. Yesterday, all four service chiefs testified as the potential impacts. There's really not much I can add to their comments on the official record. In the meantime, we're trying to be the good stewards of our infrastructure and reduce budgets and to continue to provide combat readiness to support our national interests. On May 4th, the U.S. Navy will honor the state of Alaska by commissioning the USS Anchorage in the port of Anchorage. This will be the first U.S. Navy ship commissioned in Alaska. An amphibious transport dock ship designated as LPD 23, it will be available for tours from the port of Anchorage for this ceremony. The USS Anchorage is a San Antonio-class LPD built in New Orleans and Christian in May 14th of 2011. The USS Anchorage will provide amphibious lift for the Marines, vehicles, and cargo. It can also act as an aviation platform. Alaska's military units and installations have been busy doing great things for the state and for the U.S. and will continue to do so. We remain committed to supporting our service members and their families and ensuring readiness to answer our nation's call. Thank you for your continued support of our servicemen and women who call Alaska home. The great land is truly second to none. Thank you.
Thank you, General Hogue. Appreciate your presentation. For the record, I want to acknowledge that Senator Huggins is here, Senator President Huggins, and I understand that Lieutenant General Tom Case is with us by teleconference. Just want to confirm, General Case, you can hear us? and we can trust the teleconference system. Great. Any questions for General Hogue on that presentation? Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you. Wish you'd throttled back a little bit and gone a little slower. A few years ago, there was discussion about expanding the mission of NORAD to include the maritime and terrestrial domain. What's happened with that?
General Jacoby, that's one of his stated goals, is to increase maritime domain awareness. In short, not a lot of progress has been made. There are studies on how to more effectively begin to gain that awareness. A lot of what we have is based on District 17's ability to use the automatic interrogation system for those cooperative ships that either have the beacons or the local maritime interrogators on their vessels. But from a non-cooperative point of view, ships that are not using that system, the answer is we've not made much progress. And that is why General Jacoby has made that one of his focus areas in NORTHCOM.
I may continue. I've heard the last few years the Russian bear bombers have been showing a bit on the edges of our airspace. Is that true?
It is. We've actually decreased the number of intercepts we've done. We did 28 in 10. I think it was 25 and 11, and this last year we did 10. But it's actually picked up as of recently in terms of months of activity. There's nothing threatening. It's not as if they're doing something back in the Cold War days. But they've developed some capability that we've had for years. They now have the Russian equivalent of GPS. They're now refueling much more often. And you add a satellite communications to a bear bomber that can refuel with GPS, they can now transit just like we can transit with our B-52s and B-2s anywhere in the world and be very accurate in their navigation. So nothing provocative, but I would say they've been watching us conduct operations for the last 20 years, and they're starting to exercise their long-range aviation in the same way that we would use ours.
Is there a gap in our submarine surveillance with ADAC closed?
Sir, I don't know that answer. I have to get back to you on that.
Thank you, Senator Representative Feige, and Representative Ledoux.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. General, on the subject of the Clear Air Force Station and the power plant there, I understand that you're planning to connect to the local grid. You'll heat the place with diesel and shutter the coal plant. Now, I know there was an effort at one point to see if you could farm that coal plant out to some kind of private entity and turn it into a power producer that could then feed, its capacity is about 22 megawatts or so, feed that power into the Golden Valley grid. Now, that power would be powered by coal, locally available coal, and it could, in theory, replace diesel-generated electrical load in the Golden Valley grid. From what I understand, part of the reason that privatization effort fell through is that the Air Force was not willing to let the air permit go. The air permit that would be grandfathered in to that coal plant was not willing to let that air permit go along with the power plant. Is there any way that the Air Force could do that to help move that along and be able to provide that sort of cheaper source of electricity to the area? I understand that the project was not being run out of your headquarters. It was being run out of an office in Colorado Springs. A couple of guys that had never been to Alaska before were trying to figure out what to do.
Exactly. U.S. Space Command actually owns and operates Clear Station. I can get back to you the specifics on the permitting piece. From what I understand, the permitting had been downscoped a while ago to affect savings by the reduced energy consumption of the newer design radar. And the current permit that's under operation is only in the tune of 4 to 5 megawatts, not the 23. So I'm not sure it was a matter of letting go, but when the Air Force permitted that facility without having to generate the excess of 20 megawatts, they only elected to get a license for the lower amount. So I'm not sure it was a letting go piece, but we can dig into that. And you hit the fundamental the challenge, and one of the reasons I started this energy group across the DOD, especially in the interior, and that we have installations ranging from Wainwright all the way out to Clear, then down to Greeley and up, And each of them are struggling in one way or another to find out what the best way to do their own individual solution is. But Wainwright is trying to wheel power down to Greeley to save money. Eielson has got capacity. It's on the grid, but we don't wheel it. And then Clear was out there, and one of the first questions I asked is, why don't we tap into some of that, wheel it down to Greeley? And that's when I found out that Air Force Base Command had already been almost 18 months into the study. And at the time, they were they had the enhanced use lease option on the table, waiting for someone to come back with a proposal. So I was probably late to need to try to get this body together. As I understand, Space Command is executing their decision right now to hook up to the grid and downsize. And of course, the other thing that goes with that is the challenge of upgrading the facility, the coal plant, to meet current EPA standards. And when they did the entire analysis of what it would cost to upgrade and how much power you got at the size of that facility, the feedback we had from the private side is it's not economical to operate a commercial power plant at such a low output. But at the end of the day, we're open to any idea that makes things, you know, better and cheaper to operating in the interior. So, but I'll have to defer to Air Force Base Command, and I can put you in touch with those who are executing that part of it, sir.
Yeah, thank you, General.
You have Representative Ledoux, then Isaacson.
General, you were testifying about the Russian planes and their encroachment.
Representative, could you use the microphone a little closer to you, please?
Sorry. General, you were testifying about the Russian planes and their encroachment and their intercepts, and you said that there was nothing provocative about it. So I guess since they have good GPS systems, what are they doing there?
Well, they're not actually encroaching. I mean, it's not as if they fly into our inner ADIZ off the 12 miles. They are outside what we would consider our warning airspace. And just like when we conduct missions, strategic reconnaissance, there are certain rules about how close you can come to a country to stay outside of their international or their recognized airspace. So they have not encroached over Alaska proper, but they're operating off the north coast, sometimes in the Gulf, and off the south chain of the Aleutians. As a matter of fact, this last summer they flew a mission all the way down to off the coast of California. It was one of the first times they've flown that long in a long time. Eventually ending up about 60 miles northwest of San Francisco. And they were tracked the entire time they did that.
Follow up. And so when you intercept them, have they gone just a little bit further than international law allows them to?
No, they've been doing everything in accordance with the international ICAO procedures, so there's been no issues there whatsoever.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Isaacson. You don't need a mic, do you, Doug?
Well, thank you very much. If you would, Mr. Chair, I have about three questions.
Certainly.
Thank you. So, General, thank you very much for being here and for sharing with the legislature and for the people of Alaska what the military in Alaska is doing. We really appreciate that. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we end up on the opposite side of the discussion, as you know, but you're always a willing participant and really appreciate the efforts of transparency and information, the depth of information. And in that light, I'd like to ask you a few questions. An easy one to start off with, perhaps, is in the exercise listed for 2014, there's no red flags. Are there going to be red flags scheduled in 2014, or is that to be determined?
The short answer is we're planning on red flags in 2013. When I was speaking about the major exercises on 14, is I was looking forward to talk about how we are partnering with the National Guard and the state to do the incident response in the similar to the Great Alaskan earthquake. The normal air exercises and Army exercises they were doing, those are going to be planned as a matter of course. So as you know, we've been doing about three red flag equivalents a year. We did three last year. We'll do three this year. One of them is Northern Edge. I see no reason we wouldn't do in 2014. The biggest issue, like anything else, is going to be funding.
To follow up on that one, is just I had heard rumor perhaps that there wasn't anything in the budget for exercises in 2014, maybe 2015. When does that normally get into the budget process then, since this is a federal budget?
Well, I think that's the $6 million question. I mean, I'm not sure how many exercises we're going to have in 13 until we know how much money we get to execute. Okay. So at the end of the day, I would tell you that Pacific Air Forces uses about 13 or 3 red flags a year as a good intermediate mix of how to optimize their training, as well as bringing units in to do some local flying as well. So in terms of the budget, I can't answer that until we have some greater visibility on it.
And I take it some of that will be answered in the upcoming months.
Exactly.
Another question, if I may, Mr. Chair, has to do with the, on page 23, you have the environmental impact studies. One of them is the resumption of year-round firing opportunity supplemental EIS. That has to do with JBEAR, but you mentioned that you want to resume this in lieu of using interior ranges in the winter. Could you explain that a little bit more, because being an interior guy and thinking J-Park and all this, how does that enhance operations in JBEAR, or is it necessary to complete transfer of F-16s to JBEAR? I don't know. I'm just asking the question.
From what I understand, this was an Army initiative, and I think it stemmed from environmental impact of phosphorus on the flats from about a decade ago. And during the course of the cleanup and the mitigation, the Army adjusted its training to accommodate that operation. And now what they're trying to do is get back where they can do what they call their basic table of firing at JBEAR within the equipment they have. Obviously, there's some equipment they use that is large enough caliber that they can't shoot at JBEAR and they would go into the interior. But for the basic smaller size munitions, if they can train locally, that it reduces costs from having to pack up and go north.
Understood. One final question.
Last question, Representative Isaacson.
Thank you. Regarding your ALCOM Executive Energy Steering Group, you mentioned that it was quarterly meetings. Is this committee involved, or is there ways that we as legislators could be involved with that so that we have a better understanding of the cost of energy in running our military bases, and perhaps in some way then help run interference when possible and when needed? To help maintain the profile of our bases and actually the existence of our bases in Alaska?
You know, my first reaction is ultimately yes. The first meeting we had was DOD only, because quite honestly we didn't know what each of us didn't know. As always, we had some really smart guys who've been doing this for years, and we said, so what are you doing and what are you doing? In the second meeting, we opened it up a little bit more. We had some folks come in and brief. And my intent is to open it up. It's a public forum so that we can just highlight the issues. And whether it's the legislators, whether it's private industry, whether it's the university, it's just to put the issues out there and say, this is where we are. This is the status of what it costs. I think we all are waiting to see what the latest changes might be to the coal-fired restrictions that might be levied by the EPA. So we don't know what the impact of those may be until they're actually published, and then we can each take a look to see about the state of our plant, how many have the current scrubbers, how many don't. So the short answer is we'll be as open and transparent as we can. And matter of fact, General Cactus was sitting next to me in the last one, so we can take a look at it. And Admiral Ostebo's got his Coast Guard reps all the way down at Sitka, sharing how they're using biomass to both meet the renewable piece as well as save energy.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Thank you, Representative. Appreciate it. Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. General, always good to see you. Welcome back to Juneau. Two quick questions. First is, can you talk a little bit about the impacts of the 11th Air Force restructuring, jobs, economic mission? And then second question is, if you could talk a little bit about Alaska's readiness in light of the North Korean nuclear missile tests.
For the first question, I'd like to tell you they gave me an increased staff of 15 people. I'm arguing for 4. I might end up with 2. It's just the nature of the beast right now. So I've got 2 other wing commanders, both of which, one is a general at Guam at Anderson, and one is a colonel. And quite honestly, what they've done is they've put the what I call the administration functions underneath me. The operational functions, for example, the mission planning is still going to go directly to headquarters PACAF and its warfighting role in support of PACOM and Admiral Locklear. So I get the court-martials, promotions, and that aspect for it.
Just follow up on that, Mr. Chair. What about the retiring of the 4 C-130s? Is that sort of more?
I'll let General Cactus speak to the airplane aspect itself. The part that really came from the active side was the disestablishment of the active associate. And to use what we call total force integration, one organization will own the iron, and another organization will contribute pilots and maintainers to fly and maintain those aircraft. So, for example, in the F-22s, we have the active duty squadrons, and they have reservists who fly and help maintain those aircraft. That's the associate this way. The attempt here was to plus up the capability of the C-130s in Alaska by adding some additional active duty service members, not because the airplanes are not being maintained, but with the additional four airplanes, it would be a chance to better utilize and fly the iron that we had in the inventory. When the Air Force made the decision to downsize the number of C-130s, they looked across the Air Force and saw where we had capacity, and they said, we don't need the active associate up here in Alaska anymore. And I'm not familiar. Do we have any other active associate C-130s?
Across the world.
Across the
U.S.
Okay. Okay. So there might be two active associates. It's more common to have something on like a C-17 because that's a more heavily tasked asset day to day. So that's where that decision was made. And we were about halfway through the buildup when it was put on hold for the initial budget. We stopped there, and the decision was made to go ahead and stop the active associates. So those active duty servicemen will be leaving over the next 12 to 18 months as they fade out. And then the final question was a North Korean. I was part of a teleconference yesterday with Admiral Locklear and all of his regional commanders, from General Thurman on the peninsula to General Carlisle to the Navy Pacific Fleet commander. And you know, obviously, Admiral Locklear is keenly aware of the North Korean recent nuclear blast, and all of those discussions are going on at the highest level in terms of what the U.S.'s response is going to be, both diplomatically and whatever options they decide from the Department of State and the President. So I don't have any more specific details on that. Our aircraft remain ready, as they have been, in F-22s, the tankers, so there's really no change to the readiness posture of our force. And I can't speak to any changes that might be made on the missile defense side of the House.
Thank you. Senator Conkle?
Thank you. Thank you, General. Two things. First of all, your mention of the fallen soldiers, totally appropriate. Many of us get to go and honor those fallen soldiers, and I've been to far too many of them. But it's a reminder, again, of if they were willing to do that for our country, then the stuff that we get left to do in their stead is very, very important. So I appreciate that. So thank you for that. And like you, under the sequestration question that you get to live in, the Interior has lived under the question mark of the value to the United States of Eielson Air Force Base. I think what I'd like for you to at least take back for discussion with your peers is the EIS process really didn't line up well for us, because the impact to the Interior from JPARC would be probably significantly different if the EIS had been started earlier for Eielson. And that lineup really was unfortunate, because I think the impact is significantly different one from the other. Take Eielson out of the equation, then the JPARC becomes a significant different impact to the Interior. And so I'm hoping that you'll have that conversation down the road. We find ourselves in a very difficult circumstance. It's nothing we can do about it. But I'm hoping that you'll at least send the message uphill that that was a really unfortunate set of circumstances for the Interior, because it changed the whole dynamic of one EIS having almost false information. But you're going to go ahead on the JPARC under that EIS, when the EIS for Eielson probably would have changed that dynamic significantly. So I just wanted to bring it up.
Yes, sir. I've had conversations with General Carlisle and General Malachowski, who came out and actually did the presentations. What I would say is that, given the way these have lined up, the one comment that when I talk with General Malachowski is just how professional and how well the entire team was treated during the visit up there, despite this lineup, like you said. So I will take that message back.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Are there any questions from public members of the committee? Let's Representative Tarr, Senator Dyson, then we do need to leave time for the other two presenters here today. We're going until 1 o'clock. So Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just have a question. Good morning. Thank you for being here. About the 2014 exercises, the central theme being major earthquake response. Are you planning to have a civilian component to those exercises, or is there a way to follow up to ensure that, you know, the civilians would be able to complement in the case of a major event like that?
Well, I need to change that paradigm. The response is primarily civilian through the state. So the Alaskan Department of Emergency Management and everything else, they're the ones who are going to be in the lead, and then followed right behind them by the Alaska National Guard. Our role is to basically to be there in as a backstop and to fill in the known gaps. If we've got a capacity at J-Bear to do something like bridging equipment, we have bridging equipment at J-Bear. For us to have it there, it can complement the state's equipment, and they will go put up a bridge when they're told to. So it really, what we're trying to do is synchronize with the state, because us having an exercise within the confines of J-Bear is interesting but not relevant. If we're not practicing with the state, then we're really not doing what we need to do. So the entire intent, and that's what we're trying to do with Tom's folks, is to integrate our efforts with the state's efforts so we can get that part done.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Senator Dyson, you have a question?
Yeah. Thank you. There's two magnificent airports, I think, at King Salmon and Cool Bay. And those, I think, serve as an emergency landing spot. Mm-hmm. Are they still in your jurisdiction, and do you have some responsibility for maintaining them?
King Salmon is still in our emergency aircraft divert file, so we still maintain King Salmon as an emergency divert at this time. But we don't maintain Cold Bay from the air side.
Is there any others?
No, other than the Coast Guard air stations. We don't. King Salmon and Galena has long since shut down.
One more short question, Representative Isaacson, and then we'll need to move on to other folks.
Thank you. Thank you very much. General, you mentioned the EIS is going back to that. I just heard from the mayor of Fairbanks North Star Borough two nights ago that there is another EIS going on for Fort Wainwright. Could you tell us about this? From my understanding, it's Fort Wainwright could either gain 1,000 troops or lose 4,000 troops, and public comment is due by the end of this month. Do you have...
I believe that's the third or fourth one I mentioned here is a PEA.
And the programmatic environmental assessment? No.
I can get you more specific information on that, but that's the one that the Department of Army basically said that given their force structure where they've been directed to reduce the 50 or 60,000 soldiers, they looked across all their installations and said that they may anywhere go from, I think, either up to 1,000 or down 4,000. General Odierno was out here a few months ago, and I believe the Secretary of the Army was out here about a month ago as well up in the Fairbanks area. So I can't speak for the Department of the Army other than to say that that process is their equivalent of trying to make adjustments either by force structure or unit realignments.
All right. Just for the record, Mr. Chairman, if Fort Wainwright loses 4,000 troops and Eielson loses half of that number, we've lost two-thirds of our economic pillar in the Fairbanks area.
Understood. General Hogue, if you do have any information about that, I'd appreciate getting that, and we can distribute it to the members of the committee. And to understand, that is there a 30-day timeline for comments, for public comment on that PEA? Did I hear you say that?
Whatever that timeline is, there's a graph there, and each one has specific months, and it's all outlined by law. So wherever they are in that process, we can get that back to you.
General Katkus and Deputy Commissioner Pierre, I'm sure, have that information. We can get that, General.
Okay.
With that, General Hope, thank you very much for your presentation. I'm sure we could ask questions and have a great discussion all day long, but we all have time constraints. So with that, I thank you for your presentation and would invite Major General Katkus.
Thank you.
Come forward. For the record, General Katkus, could you give us your name, affiliation, and your partner there?
Mr. Chairman, Tom Katkus. I'm the Commissioner for the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs and also the Adjutant General for the Alaska National Guard. With me today is Deputy Commissioner McHugh Pierre, the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. I've been given a pretty simple task. What I consider is to show off the National Guard this morning. So I think I would like to do a brief introduction to the method that we're going to show off the National Guard today. I was asked to provide a video. This video is an effort by a second lieutenant. So this is the type of skill set that we have in today's military. I think you'll be impressed with the quality. This same gentleman, I was advised, won 5 national level awards. It was announced last night in the National Guard competition for public affairs. So it's a quality video, but what this demonstrates, it's a little bit more than just the National Guard. It demonstrates the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. A lot of what General Hoag had presented, you heard the National Guard being mentioned there. Those operational missions demonstrate the partnership between our military forces up here in Alaska. So this video further demonstrates the cooperation within the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, how our Department of Homeland Emergency Management works with Joint Task Force Alaska, how we work with other agencies across the state, how our National Guard support every operational mission going on in Alaska for the most part, even to the point where our veterans are then taken care of in such a manner that we try to make sure that Alaska is the place to retire, the place to take your family. So with that, Mr. Chairman, if I could, we'll go through the video. And then the last tasking that I was asked is to provide information on our deployments, and I'll have that immediately after the video. If we could dim the lights a little bit there. Thank you so much. This is the way people communicate now, is by videos. So this is very good.
In an American town where the military has set out to move mountains, mountains of snow.
When we got the request for support from Cordova, there were several things we had to consider. One is we had to get there fast, we had to get there with aid that was not a drain on the community, and we needed to have the discipline to live under bad conditions. And we decided very immediately that the National Guard was the way to do this mission.
We desperately needed the extra bodies, extra manpower, extra equipment. We are all extremely grateful for the National Guard right now.
Let's see if we can get that thing out of the road.
I was in a building, but the wind was so strong, it was rocked the building. It would surprise me if we were 120 miles. It'd be different if it was just the wind or the rain. But when you have both, you have massive flooding going on and everything else. This is just, I've been here since 92. And I've never seen
it.
The City Emergency Operations Center is the focal point for all of that information coming in. Requests from local government, providing information to other agencies that need to know what's going on in the disaster event. The State Emergency Operations Center is the place where all of that coordination and support happens. That's what really makes the state's job easier. Like I said previously, it's important that individuals and families have a disaster supply kit at their home that has adequate food, water for their family to support them for 7 days, medicine, vital records, all of the things that you would need following a catastrophic event.
Our care, which is transporting equipment and doctors, nurses, veterinarians, and social workers, here in the 10 minutes and that's an hour now that would be right to study right now, like it is all over. Then we 15, 20 minutes to get close up real quick.
Oh yeah, very rewarding. I mean, we're finding these patients aren't having glasses and we're turning around in less than a day.
It's not only about providing the actual health care, but it's education too. We can come in and educate them on how to take care of their eyes, to wear sunglasses, because of the teaching and the instructing that we've done to help them take care of themselves is amazing.
You read the preamble to the U.S. Constitution. that says that establishing justice and keeping the peace are the first two goals in government. And what this company was doing in several different places in Afghanistan was helping the provinces establish a legitimate government. And that's just tremendous. I think these soldiers will remember this for the rest of their lives. It's something incredible that's going on.
That's all I can think about. I dream about it. And to get home and actually be able to hug my loved ones and see them again for the first time in so long, it's a huge thing.
A Hurricane Sandy crashing on shore, winds now at 90 miles per hour, and this storm is so big, so vast, 60 million Americans will feel its power.
We are in the midst of a massive operation to move utility vehicles, power vehicles, from the Southern California area to the New York, New Jersey area, which is currently millions of customers are without power.
Oh, it's great. We're doing a small team because I used to deploy with the Marine Corps, so this was different. We flew everything in the south last time we were up north. So we were able to fly a lot more missions, right?
What they're deploying means for the state of Alaska is they are on the front lines. They're serving us. They've got families behind as well. They have to support in any way we can. So we appreciate them. We appreciate their service. And we're here to help support their families.
Brave and courageous warriors exited an aircraft while in flight by a cable hoisting system under extreme and intense circumstances to recover fellow combatants wounded during ground combat operations with the enemy.
There's just so much more than just a medal, and it's you know, it's not about me, it's not about the medal, it's about the sacrifices that, you know, we as soldiers make on a daily basis, and that soldiers are still doing.
We found another Alaska Territorial Guard member that is actively living. Most people within our communities don't even know what these elderly guys did for us. We were able to find this individual and actually reward him for his service and present him with his honor and discharge.
Honor Guard shows defining respects for the fallen soldier, as well as shows most families the last thing they'll ever see at the military is to show the family how much we care for them. It's to show our respect to that fallen soldier.
And you have my great respect for this. You are without doubt one of the best classes in the history of this program.
We all came to this program for different reasons. Where some needed discipline, others needed school credit. Some had little say in the matter, or came for lack of a better option. Regardless of our reasons for entering AMYA, we have all received something valuable from our time here.
S&P Guardsmen College is a program for guardsmen and reservists to be in RTC and be a drilling guardsman or reservist at the same time.
I joined the Alaska National Guard for the benefits for college because I looked at college and I wanted to go all these different places and study all these different things, and I realized, wow, I have no way of paying for this.
The program really helps kids succeed by mentorship. I think one of the best opportunities that we have is the cadres, at least two times a semester, to meet with cadets to make sure they're on track academically, financially, physically fit, and just all around a good character for the program.
Lockheed Martin, of course, was selected Kodiak for their FEMA program. The state in this legislative section provided us $25 million of seed money to start the work on developing the Launch Pad 3. And that really has secured Lockheed Martin's commitment to Kodiak. Because now it shows that there's viability, and not just for Launch Pad 3 and Lockheed Martin, but with other customers that are very interested in this.
And it meant a lot to us that people back here in Alaska, our home state,
thinking about us and writing us letters.
We can invite various community and industry leaders to come and just not only celebrate Alaska, but also the invaluable institutions that give so much to the community, and in particular our wounded warriors who gave so much for their country, and we hope we can give a little back to them.
He has a Duchenne muscular dystrophy. He's 9 years old. Life expectancy right now is
we dropped everything for this and pretty much spent the entire day. We've been prepping for him for the past couple of weeks. So that's experience we could give him a wooden amount of time.
It melts your heart no matter what. They're kids. And, to see them opening presents and just having a good time, it just melts your heart. So, even the hardest pilot, he melts once he sees those kids opening the presents with them.
Speaking of, this is saying we are going to change our community. We're going to put people in place that will represent us well. As the governor is doing now in 123 communities in a short over 3 years in Mexico, and that has demonstrated physical presence and community outspokenly saying they're no longer going to be a
about 4 years of today's participants, as well as your predecessor and those to come in your footsteps, Congress completed its own show to the detriment of the defense forces of all of your countries as well.
And I think we finally, after 20 years, realize this is an option to bring our state workforce in, other areas that make efficiency and synchronization of resources in today's resource-constrained environment absolutely essential. NORTHCOM now sees that as, that's a model example of how state and federal partners should be getting together and making good things happen at time of disasters and time of need.
So with that, with painting the white lines for some of our young men and women to go forward, they can put together some pretty good imagery. The hard part is getting it all compressed into that amount of time, but they did a great job throughout the year of collecting as much as they could of all that we're doing. It definitely took the liberty of stealing a little bit of Admiral Ostapo's imagery there, because our next initiative is trying to move a large section of his organization and co-locate it with us out there on J-Bear, and as we move forward, even greater synergy is going to occur. Senator, I think what I found earlier to your question on the associate units, I found at least two in Arkansas and Wyoming, and I've got a message out to see if I can find some other ones out there, so I'll get that answer back to you. Second portion of my presentation today is future deployments. Looking forward to the Army National Guard there, you see 292 roughly for 2013. The preponderance of those are our brand new military police unit that we have just reorganized into, and they've got a mission already, and that is to go to Guantanamo Bay for a year and provide security at that location. Currently, even as we speak, we have approximately 54 of our air warriors with our Blackhawk UH-60s going down to Fort Hood in preparation for a year-long deployment over in Kuwait. The Mongolian rotation, every 6 months, we continue to put two soldiers with a Mongolian unit that is forward in Afghanistan, and the other individuals are doctors, dentists, etc., that deploy with our units. Next slide, please. Our 168th Wing, we continue to provide fuel all over the world. Everybody needs a tanker, everybody needs fuel, and we are extremely relevant and extremely pressed to maintain those missions. Next slide. 176, they have now relocated. They're out there on J-Bear. They are falling into a regular op tempo, which is manageable, very much accepting the new facilities that they are in, and still at the same time getting ready to go forward to Kuwait and continue operations across the world. Next slide, please. With that, great picture showing the cooperative effort between a Black Hawk and HA-60 and the Coast Guard as an example of great cooperative work that your National Guard does with its active duty forces in today's world of having to be operational and keep up with the Joneses and participate equally with everyone out there. Any questions, please?
Thank you, General Kakis. Appreciate the presentation. You do have some dynamic people preparing your video stuff. That's outstanding work. Questions for General Kakis? General Canales.
Two quick things, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. First off, I'm a huge supporter of infrastructure that makes long-term sense for the state, and I was delighted to hear General Kakis talk to me earlier about the Tanana River Bridge and the progress that's going on. Would you comment briefly on that?
The Tanana River Bridge, Deputy Commissioner McHugh and myself got up there recently to take a look at the project. It is under budget and on time. The 2014 time frame should be the date and time that it's a dual modal bridge, which means it carries railroad trains and wheeled vehicles or track vehicles. So it's set up in order to support J-Park. The Army will be able to cross the Tanana River Bridge in 2014 to have the option of year-round training access. That was a vision that was initially established by General Troy, General Jacoby, General Layfield for safety, primarily to keep those large vehicles off of the road system and into the training areas. So access over there provides a mile-long bridge maintained by the Alaska Railroad for the next 100 years and tremendous year-round guaranteed access, not dependent upon weather, and a singular ice bridge across that big obstacle. What does the state of Alaska benefit from? The last major obstacle for a railroad into and through our interior is now being crossed. So it's great on both sides. Monetarily, the state of Alaska put up $88 million as their portion, and the federal government put up a little over $100 million. So it's a great partnership across the board and sees good things continuing to happen on that tremendous project.
Thank you. And then, Mr. Chairman, last year I was in Mongolia, in Ulaanbaatar, and I met with our defense attaché, and this Mongolian partnership is way more than feel good. He told me that thanks to the Alaska National Guard, the Mongolian forces are now certified with the United Nations for peacekeeping around the world, and that in turn brings millions of dollars to that country. So it's just another example of our small state doing great, great things.
Thank you for those comments, General Canales. That's exactly right. Our National Guard is so much more than the local hometown community heroes that they are. They're expanded and out and about.
And actually, I've known some folks who went to Mongolia and with some of the training with the Guard, and they said they're just like us. Well, some subtle differences, maybe. other questions for General Kakis?
Mr. Chairman, I have some answers to previous questions for the record. McHugh Pierre. We have the Army PEA, which was referenced earlier. That is the personnel environmental assessment. The original deadline was Friday, tomorrow, for comments. It has been extended to the end of the month. So the deadline for comments, end of the month, Mr. Chairman.
You'll provide that information. We can make sure all the members have the opportunity to comment on that, because as Representative Isaacson said, that would be another bad blow to the interior. Any more questions? Fantastic. Well, thank you for an efficient presentation. I appreciate knowing all the Guards doing in Alaska and abroad. And I'm sure we'll continue talking to you as the session progresses.
Mr. Chairman and members of the group, thank you very much for having us here today. And as always, we're available for any questions, comments, or anything that you'd like to be in touch with us for. Thank you very much on behalf of the men and women of the National Guard.
With that, I would invite the Coast Guard to the stand, Rear Admiral Tom Ostebo. Very much appreciate you making the effort, making the time to come down to the Capitol. Glad to see you here, sir.
Well, I do want to start by stating for the record that I have to follow Tom Cactus's movie, and that makes it fun. Although I could have brought a episode of Coast Guard Alaska, which might have been as interesting. Chairman Kelly, Chairman Sadler, the rest of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak here today. I am Rear Admiral Tom Ostebo, Commander of the Coast Guard 17th District. I have with me my aide, Kerry Dunning. I'm honored to accompany Lieutenant General Hogue and Major General Kakis in providing exceptional leadership for the Department of Defense and National Guard forces that call Alaska home. Together, we make up a strong team that serves both the state and the national government. I look forward to speaking with you today to talk about the great work that the Coast Guard men and women are doing here in the last frontier. And we'll be updating you on some of the Coast Guard activities, to include our events of Arctic Shield 2012, and most recently, the Kolik grounding incident off of Kodiak. The Coast Guard in Alaska. Distinguished members, the Coast Guard in Alaska achieves operational excellence every day through leadership, teamwork, and professionalism. Our goals are to serve and safeguard the public, protect the environment and its resources, and defend the nation's interests in the Alaska maritime regime. Through seamless cooperation with our sister services, And with close collaboration with federal, state, local, and tribal partners, we do this every day, and we do it with expertise. On the average month, and this is just for a month, on an average month, nearly 3,000 dedicated Coast Guard men and women conduct 51 search and rescue cases and assist with saving the lives of 74 people in Alaska. We board 161 vessels every month. We service over 60 aids to navigation. We respond to 10 pollution incidents a month on average, and we help with the safe transport of over 70 million gallons of oil and 1.4 million pounds of explosives around the state on a monthly basis. Annually, we save about 800 people a year in the state of Alaska and deliver their lives back to their loved ones. We conduct these missions throughout through operations coordinated here by D-17 Command Center and with major commands located in Anchorage and in Juneau. We have two major air stations, one in Kodiak, which is the largest Coast Guard facility in the nation, and we have an air station in Sitka. We have small boat stations, patrol boats, buoy tenders, marine safety teams located throughout the state from Ketchikan out to Dutch Harbor, and this past summer as far north as Barrow. We are proud of our mission, we are proud of our successes, and we are honored to serve the people of Alaska. Last year, D-17 re-engaged in the Arctic with a major program called Arctic Shield 2012. Coast Guard District 17 proposed Arctic Shield 2012 to respond to the dramatic increases in Arctic activity resulting from diminished sea ice and longer open water periods. The mission there had three primary objectives. One, operational excellence and to refamiliarize the Coast Guard with operating north of the Arctic Circle. Two, capability assessment so that we could test our equipment and new equipment to be used in the Arctic across all of our missions. And three, outreach to the local community to help educate us in our work up there. Today I sit before you and assure you that Arctic Shield 2012 was a resounding success, overcoming the obstacles of distance, logistical challenges, and working with the absence of a deep water port. The lessons learned and experience gained from our activities north of the Arctic Circle will help refine and improve the Coast Guard's Arctic presence in the near term with a weather eye towards providing long-term strategic presence in the region. In particular, D-17's Arctic operations last year consisted of the following. We opened a seasonal air facility in Barrow. For the first time, we had a Coast Guard footprint on the beach almost 100 years north of the Arctic Circle. Our forward operating location in Barrow consisted of two H-60 helicopters, their crews, maintenance personnel, transportable communications center, and supporting personnel. And our H-60 flew over 289 flight hours, conducted 11 search and rescue cases, saved four lives, and assisted with the saving of six other lives. We conducted ice reconnaissance, maritime domain awareness, and provided VIP and Homeland Security support all summer long, as well as support for the state and other federal agencies. In addition to the H-60s, we had C-130s deployed to the Arctic almost continuously from Kodiak, which is 820 miles away. We provided 70 logistics flights, moved over 1 million pounds of cargo and fuel, conducted 15 maritime domain awareness sorties, and over 34 hours of ice reconnaissance. In addition, the C-130s were used for medical transportation and search and rescue across the region. In addition to our aviation assets, we had a minimum of at least two Coast Guard cutters operating offshore throughout the drill season last summer. Those cutters operated across our mission sets of Arctic domain awareness, search and rescue, law enforcement, and had a particular mission to provide the safety zones around both of the drill rigs, not only in the Arctic, but while they were down in Dutch Harbor and during their transit from Dutch Harbor north of the Arctic Circle. Most recently, the Coast Guard has been extremely active, and you've probably noticed in the press, with the mobile drilling unit Kulik and its grounding off the coast of Kodiak. I'm sure, like many Alaskans, you follow the dramatic rescue and the follow-on events in the media. I'm proud to report that, as of today, our two main goals in this mission, starting with the beginning of the SAR case that lasted almost 5 days, and to as early as today have been accomplished. And that first goal was, and I laid this out for my staff at the very beginning, is nobody gets killed and we don't get anybody hurt. And number two is we have no environmental damage and no pollution. And both of those objectives have been, as of today, completed. I'm also honored to represent the air station crews that went out there and rescued the 18 people from the Kulik in a 45-foot sea in hurricane weather. They were managed to pull 18 people off of there and get them to safety. Truly, truly a dramatic and heroic rescue case that will be added to the great history of the Coast Guard up here in Alaska. Based on the uncertainty around the grounding and the preceding SAR case, I have convened a formal Coast Guard Marine casualty investigation into this matter that will investigate all aspects of the grounding, including its support vessels, the equipment that was used, and investigating the possible errors or mistakes that may have happened. This investigation will allow the Coast Guard to potentially save lives and protect the environment by identifying what went wrong and how these types of incidents may be avoided in the future. It's also like to pass on to everybody that as of yesterday, we stood down the Unified Command in Anchorage on this case. The tow plans have been submitted to the Coast Guard. We have reviewed those plans, and with some minor edits, they are complete. And we would expect in the next few days for the Kulik to be leaving Clio Bay and heading on to its next port of call and ultimately overseas for repair. As you can see, the Coast Guard has been extremely busy, and our work throughout the throughout Alaska continues to grow. Maritime activity from Dixon Entrance to the Arctic EEZ out to the Unimak Pass is expanding. And as it does, you can always count on the United States Coast Guard to be there and to be Semper Paratus. So this concludes my comments, and subject to your questions, I want to once again say thank you very much for giving the Coast Guard the opportunity to testify here today, and I look forward to your questions. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Admiral Osbo. Appreciate it. Questions for Admiral Osbo? Representative Isaacson.
Thank you. Just one for clarification. Arctic EEZ?
I'm sorry, the exclusive economic zone, which is out to 200 miles around the state.
Thank you.
Representative Dyson.
Yeah. Thank you, Admiral. Can you update us on what on the recommissioning of, I think it's the Polar Star, and whether or not the Polar Sea will be treated similarly?
Yes, sir. As you know, the Coast Guard currently has one operating icebreaker in the Coast Guard cutter Healy, and we saw from her mission last year that she's extremely valuable, particularly up here in Alaska. We have two other major icebreakers that are in caretaker status. The Polar Star is about to come out. Actually, it's underway now, getting sea trials, and she is in the process of being reactivated. Polar Star is the largest conventionally powered icebreaker in the world, most powerful, and she'll be back in service by next summer with some early run-up work taking place up here in Alaska. She comes up here to break some ice and get her crews trained up, and then she'll be turning down towards Antarctica to help with McMurdo breakout next winter.
And the Polar Sea, or is that still active?
The Polar Sea will remain in caretaker status until and if funding is made available to bring her back back into service.
And just for my colleagues, I think those are the only boats that we have that are capable of multi-year ice.
That is correct. The both of the icebreakers are capable of breaking multi-year ice and providing a presence in the Arctic year-round. They're the only ones we have. Healy, while quite capable, is limited in her icebreaking capability. She is actually technically a medium icebreaker. The other two are heavy, world-class icebreakers.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Other questions? Representative Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Admiral, regarding the operation involving the Kulik, we generally assume that the Coast Guard will be on top of things like that, and true to form and tradition, they were. But there's also there were also other elements involved in that, basically mariners that were picked and pulled onto this unified team. And I don't know if you can talk about the actions of the tugboat, the Alert. But if you could elaborate on that.
More than happy to. Clearly, the response effort, especially through the early days of the SAR case, was a team effort, not only with the Coast Guard, but quite frankly with industry and the tug alert. I can tell you on the first night of the SAR case, I received a number of phone calls. One of them was from retired Vice Admiral Tom Barrett, who asked me if I needed help. And my answer to him was yes. And he responded for the first time, diverting a tug that is primarily focused on Prince William Sound, out of Prince William Sound for a major SAR case. Alert came out there, and I cannot say enough about the work that Alert has done. And we've actually gone down and awarded the crew a lot of recognition. They held on to, they were the last tug connected to the Kulik by the emergency towing line, a 7-inch nylon braided line. And they were so determined to keep that off the beach. They're Alaskans like the rest of us, and they were determined to keep that off the beach. I had to order them not once but twice to cut the tow line when they were about a quarter mile offshore for fear of them ending up on the beach as well and perhaps a further loss of life or loss of life as a result. They did an outstanding job. Also, the Unified Command, we went from, you look at these kinds of tragedies and try to learn from them. The Unified Command was probably the best exercise in a maritime environment that the state could have possibly have had. We went from zero folks and no Unified Command to about 750 people within about 2 days of the Kulik going aground, with all federal partners, with state, local, tribal partners from Old Town coming in to help us put together a consolidated response. So thank you for bringing that up. Clearly, that was a combined effort by everybody, not only on the active duty side, but by our state partners. So thank you, sir.
Thank you. Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you. I don't know if you have any sense of this or not, but was this just a freak sort of weather situation that occurred, or should Shell have known about this and not been in the waters at the time? Do you have any sense?
I can't really get into the specifics, but all of that will come out through our marine investigation. I will tell you that that the Weather Service and NOAA typically puts out their forecast, their reliable forecast, for about 5 days in the future. Beyond that, it gets to be less and less reliable, clearly. I can also tell you that at the same time that the Kulik was transiting from Kodiak towards Washington when she hit this bad weather, there were over 100 other vessels operating in the northern Gulf of Alaska, including a Coast Guard cutter, one of my own ships that was out there. Alaska is a maritime state. It's a state, in my opinion, that's more connected to the maritime environment from a daily sustainment perspective than any place else. So we have activity going on all the time offshore. And so whether the Kulik should have gotten underway or not on the 27th, I'm sorry, on the 21st, and then where it eventually hit this weather on the 27th of December, we'll figure that out in the maritime investigation. I can tell you that they had an extensive tow plan that was reviewed by their towing agent, by Shell Corporation itself, by the Coast Guard and other folks before they left Dutch Harbor. So all that'll come out in the formal maritime investigation, and there'll be plenty of opportunity to take a look at the due diligence that was done, if that's responsive.
Actually, General Admiral, pardon me, I've got a question for you. Given the increasing outer continental shelf activity, we hope more, and the increased shipping along the Great Silk Route and the Northwest Passage and the Northern Route, what are the long-term plans for any permanent Coast Guard presence in or near the Arctic? You know, Kodiak's great, but it's just a little far away.
Your lead up to your question actually pointed to two different areas that I think is important to talk about. One is the Great Circle Route and the growth in maritime transportation and traffic, primarily between Dixon Entrance out to Unimak Pass and over to Korea, which has...
For landlubbers here, where are those areas?
Okay, so Dixon Entrance is a international entrance between... just south of Ketchikan, between Canada and the U.S., and that leads to the fourth largest port on the west coast of the U.S. now, which is Prince Rupert, which is currently larger than Oakland in the amount of traffic that goes in and out of there. The reason for that is if you take a Kia from Korea and you run it through the Great Circle Route and into Prince Rupert, it can make it to market in Chicago or the East Coast 3 or 4 days faster than if it were to travel further south to California. Clearly, as we swing to the Pacific, as DOD swings to the Pacific, as attention swings to the Pacific, traffic and maritime commerce is increasing. We've gone from about 300 vessels a month through Unimac Pass up to 400 vessels a month, and I probably don't have to remind most of the folks here of tragedies we've had in the past, such as Solandang IU. And those types of options, they give me pause and concern for the international strait known as Unimac Pass and for the international strait known as Dixon Entrance, both of which have had major growth in maritime traffic. They present a very specific and a very interesting problem for the U.S. Coast Guard and for the state of Alaska is how we would address that traffic and respond to maritime accident, not only in the saving of life, but in responding to environmental damage that might happen by that increased traffic. In addition, as Kitimat and Prince Rupert become major exporting places for oil and perhaps gas in the future from Canada, that raises the bar. If you look at what we do in Prince William Sound to escort a tanker, and we do practically zero, actually do zero for a tanker leaving out of Dixon Entrance. So that's one part of the question, and I have the Coast Guard is working to evaluate what the best resources would be to attack that problem. In the Arctic, part of the mission of Arctic Shield 2012 was to evaluate our response capability and the assets that we have to provide a long-term presence in the Arctic. Clearly, every indication is that the Arctic will continue to grow in its relevance in the maritime community, and the Coast Guard is evaluating our strategic and long-term presence up there, both offshore with more and better capable ships, as well as an onshore presence, primarily with a seasonal air facility.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Any other questions for Admiral Ostwell? Seeing none, thank you very much for your time, sir.
And, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
At that point, I want to thank General Hoag, General Kakis, and Admiral Ostwell for being with us today, and my hope that this is going to be just one more element in a continuing conversation between the legislative leaders and the military services and agencies as we meet the opportunities and the challenges in Alaska. I hope from our discussion here it's clear that Alaska respects the military, values you, and we hope that you continue to stay here, train here, and grow here. And thank you for your time. With that, it is now 12:41, and we are adjourned. Thank you.